On this show in the past, I've talked often about big pharma, the pharmaceutical industry that makes tens of millions of dollars every single day off consumers like you and me. And we've talked about the importation of drugs with people like Dr. Peter Rost from Pfizer, the man who bravely speaks out against his own industry as a private citizen. We've had Dr. Marcia Angel, the former executive editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, on this show. And today I introduce you to someone new to this argument. Well, he's not really new to the argument, but he's got a book that's new to the argument. His name is Greg Kritzer, and for a long time he's been chronicling the pharmaceutical industry and the politics of medicine, and has now compiled quite a bit of his work into a brand new book called Generation RX, How Prescription Drugs Are Altering American Lives, Minds, and Bodies. Greg, welcome to the Paul Harris Show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. I got to tell you, when people hear how prescription drugs are altering American lives, minds, and bodies, there are some who are going to think you're Tom Cruise.
Well, that's a great lead-in. You know, it's funny. Two or three times when people have been asking me about my book, they've actually said, so are you pro-Tom or pro-Brooke? Which really kind of levels your ego down a little bit when you think you're kind of some high-flying author, you know, and so something that can be reduced to that. But no, I think that debate between those two people has to do with celebrityhood and nothing to do with medicine. So.
All right, well, let's talk about medicine. You say in the book that America has become a nation of pharmaceutical tribes. What does that mean?
Well, what I'm referring to is the consequence of 20 years of marketing of lifestyle drugs to Americans and a broad number of medical applications thereof. I think the most interesting one to me is the tribe of high performance, which is increasingly the young people in our country. And the use of attention deficit disorder drugs, hyperactivity drugs, and antidepressants. And almost to, if you look at why a child is prescribed these drugs, it all boils down to his or her performance. Usually in school, and how they or how they behave around the home. And so I was interested in exploring, first of all, is ADD a legitimate disease or a condition, and is Ritalin actually helping these children, or is it preparing them for a lifetime of increased drug use?
Do you go into something like that thinking, well, this whole ADD thing has just been pumped up by the pharmaceutical industry so they can sell more Ritalin?
Well, no, because I have the most perfect open mind of any author there ever was.
Yeah, no agenda at work here at all.
No. I think that, you know, I think it's healthy in America that we have this kind of inbred skepticism about prescription drugs or any kinds of drugs. And what I really wanted to find out was, A, are these children being helped, and B, do they have a legitimate medical condition? And what I found out, particularly with Ritalin, is that there is no really legitimate disease category that is attention deficit disorder. Okay, like we have with, let's say, diabetes. It's more of a condition. And while if everybody in a room takes a Ritalin, everybody will concentrate better. The child who's having these behavioral problems will benefit much more so than the average person who takes Ritalin. So my question was, well, if the drug is the diagnosis, then we've got a long way to go in terms of the science of the brain and treating children with these powerful drugs.
Are you saying that kids should not be on behavioral medication at all?
No, I'm not saying that, but I am saying that we've got to tighten up on our use of it. If you talk to people who are really prominent in the field and believe very strongly in the use of medications for attention deficit disorder, what they'll tell you is this: middle to upper middle class kids today, in general, are over medicated. Poorer kids are under-medicated. That is to say, poorer kids in inner-city schools who do have these behavioral problems are likely not to be medicated, where you get a lot of more wealthy kids who are taking the drug for kind of borderline conditions. And also, as we've seen recently in some new reports that have come out of Columbia University and elsewhere, when these children go on to college, they seem to have an increased capacity for drug abuse or drug-seeking behavior. And that's a whole area that the industry has not deign to study yet, and I'm hoping that they do.
Wait a minute, let me get this straight. The use of behavior modification drugs like Ritalin and others at a young age leads to drug abuse later on?
Yeah, that's one big area of inquiry that the kind of critical thinkers about attention deficit and Ritalin are looking at, because you know what Ritalin is, don't you? I mean, Ritalin is speed.
Yeah.
The reason that Ritalin is popular is because it's not named amphetamine or dexedrine, but molecularly it's very similar. So the question has always been, well, what happens to these kids later? And some of the very preliminary studies are showing that, so what they call drug-seeking behavior, whether it's through drugs of abuse, street drugs, or drugs in the medicine cabinet, that behavior is increased in the late teens and early adulthood years.
And so it's possible that some kids who don't actually have a medical condition that needs some chemical enhancement or chemical changes are actually being given drugs that are giving them a speeding high, and then later on, that's what they're trying to feed?
That's right. And it's kind of interesting. The University of California at San Francisco, which is really one of the leading departments of pharmacology, they tend to be pretty reticent about these issues because, you know, we are talking about lots of kids who are on these drugs. The head of that department came out recently, I believe it was in Time magazine, and said, let's face it, we're experimenting on these kids. So there's an enormous, not just a little bit of doubt within the academic community, there's a lot of doubt about it.
Now, as we're talking about this, I use the word behavior, you use the word performance earlier, and whenever I hear the word performance, it makes me think that we're not just talking about kids and drugs, we're talking about older people and Viagra.
Yeah, Viagra is kind of the classic lifestyle drug, and I do spend some time on that in my book, but the point I wanted to make with talking about Viagra was that it basically works on almost everybody. It's kind of like Ritalin to give them an erection, okay? But with people who have what they call erectile dysfunction, which is just a newly created disease form, it seems to work much better. And so what we really have is not just the crisis of taking too many drugs for average problems of aging, but we also have a problem of naming disease. That is to say, are we naming diseases purely because we have a pill that you will respond to or not? And what's the consequence of people going through their lives being told they have these various diseases that are really principally concoctions of the pharmaceutical industry?
Are Americans taking more drugs than ever?
Yes. That clearly we know. And you see this through a number of studies, but we've gone from about an average of about 7 prescriptions a year in the late 80s to about 12 and 14 prescriptions a year by the year 2004.
Regardless of age. So it's not just a matter of somebody, because of modern medicine and its miracles, being able to keep us alive longer and prolong the aging process and all of that sort of stuff, but delay the aging process. But this is something that's going on from kind of birth to earth?
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really great way to put it, because, you know, what you've seen is two giant things have happened. First, because of political changes in the 1980s, deregulation, et cetera, drug companies, which once behaved very much like medical companies, they had a fairly strong sense of restraint in terms of marketing. But because generic drugs became easier to make, that is to say competition, the big brand name companies all of a sudden had to start competing. And what that meant is they had to spit out drugs more often, and they had to sell more of them. At the same time, what happened to American medicine? Well, we know that managed care really came to dominate American medicine. And how does managed care make money? Well, managed care makes money partly because they substitute pills for more costly medical care, physician oversight. You take those two...
Wait a second. Stop right there. Mm-hmm. Explain that. Substituting pills for physician oversight.
Yeah. Well, the classic example is Prozac. For many, many years, the health plan, if someone was diagnosed with depression, that person went to see a therapist, okay? As soon as Prozac was introduced, almost all of the big plans cut back radically on the number of visits you could have to a therapist or a physician for your depression, and said that the first line of treatment was Prozac. So that's one way that that managed care makes money, is by substituting something that's fairly high cost, that is the physician oversight or counseling, with something that's relatively, at least to the managed care company, relatively low cost. So we have a, a situation in which on the one hand the industry itself is becoming much more aggressive in terms of selling, and then we have this kind of external reality of our own medical system and insurance systems, which encourages the uses of pills. And that's why you see these vast changes over the just 15 years, as I said, in the rate of drug use among the average American.
We're going to get to that aggressiveness on the part of the big pharmaceutical companies in terms of their selling, especially direct to consumers, in our next segment here. Before we take a break, though, what drugs are you on?
I don't discuss my medical condition.
Are you closer to the 7 pills prescriptions a year or the 12 prescriptions a year?
I'm a pretty low use person.
Okay, I'll be sending you a HIPAA form to fill out later on for this show. Greg Kritzer, the book is called Generation RX: How Prescription Drugs Are Altering American Lives, Minds, and Bodies. More of the Paul Harris Show coming up on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Greg Kritzer about his new book, Generation RX, How Prescription Drugs Are Altering American Lives, Minds, and Bodies. What is this all doing to our bodies, taking more prescriptions, popping more pills, Greg?
Well, I think the best example is some of the most popular drugs, which are drugs for what we hear termed gastroesophageal reflux disease, but which used to be called heartburn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And these are pills such as Nexium, a number of other pills. And what they work by suppressing the amount of acid that your stomach generates. Okay, now a couple of things are going on here. First of all, heartburn and GERD, which is the more dramatic form of heartburn, is not caused by too much stomach acid. Okay, it's caused by the fact that your esophageal sphincter, it's just this little kind of valve that just sits above the esophagus, is weak. And it leaks some of the acid from your stomach into your esophagus. That's where you get that burning sensation, okay? And to deal with that problem, the first-line treatment was always surgery, okay? If you had such bad heartburn that it really was eating away your esophagus, and that actually is quite rare as opposed to what they would have you believe, you would have a surgery. Well, what these drugs do, the way they work is by suppressing acid in your stomach. And what we know is that that acid in your stomach is important for two reasons. One, it acts as a germ barrier in terms of keeping diseases away from the lower part of your gut and getting into your metabolism. And secondly, it's how your body processes nutrients and minerals. So what we're starting to see now is people who have used these drugs on a daily basis for maybe 5, 10, even 15 years, and they're starting to have some of the classic problems of aging. That is to say, very bad malnutrition, anemia, what they call gastric pneumonia, a number of different diseases that result purely from the long-term use of these drugs.
Why are drugs like this approved by the FDA? I mean, we certainly went through problems with Merck and Vioxx. How do these things get through the federal approval process in the first place?
It's a very complex way of dealing with a new drug application. But basically, the reason they get through is that they're not harmful. That is to say, you can't overdose on them. That's like the low barrier, right?
Really? That's the standard? Hey, this won't kill you, so go ahead and take it.
That's right. And if it's 5% better than a placebo, that's really the cutoff point.
So wait a second. What about that whole everything that was happening to my innards in your previous answer?
I'm sorry.
Okay, this won't kill you, but it's going to really do damage to your esophageal stomach connection down there and that valve and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, that might happen, but at least it won't kill you, so here's the stamp. Go ahead, put it on the market. That's how it works?
That's in some ways, that is how it works. You put it in a much more colorful, interesting way than I would.
Okay.
But I think another good example, for example, are antidepressants, which we know from Prozac on, which we know are useful in treating kind of legitimate diagnosed adult depression. But those drugs really were only tested for about 9 months in length, okay? That was the traditional clinical trial length. Today, there are many, many thousands, if not millions of people who take those drugs for years at a time, and there's no real data that was done early on to show what is the consequence of taking those pills for long periods of time. The scariest part of it is that some of the few studies that have been done, for example, Paxil, which is manufactured by Glaxo, People who take Paxil for more than a year, and they do a brain, and we do a brain scan on them, you start to see changes in the brain stem, in the brain stem area of the cranium. And no one is sure exactly what that means, except that there is this, here is this long-term physiological structural change that no one anticipated. So there's a lot that's going on with these drugs that we don't know about, and we don't have anyone who's really tracking them with our interests completely in mind.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned Paxil, because that is a classic example to me of what I call the ask your doctor about drugs, which I think is part of the new marketing campaign, and it seems to have been only in the last 5 to 10 years. I mean, I think 20 years ago, the way you found out about a drug that you needed was you went to your doctor, they wrote a prescription that you couldn't read, you took it to the pharmacist, they gave you a bottle, and the name of the thing was on the bottle, and you probably couldn't pronounce it,
that's right.
But your doctor was the person you trusted, and so you took that pill. Now, because you have all this marketing in print and in the electronic media, people are going to their doctors and saying, hey, I think I need this pill, because they saw a commercial with a couple running through a wheat field and smiling, and it turns out that it has nothing to do with anything they actually have, but they're putting pressure on the doctor to give them that pill. Is that a complete reversal of how medication is supposed to be done, or am I wrong?
No, you're right. Your timeline that you sketched out there 20 to 25 years ago, the contrast is pretty dead on, because it was really in the early 80s that drug companies realized that because they had this competition coming from new generic companies, that they would have to introduce drugs into the market quicker, and they knew that generally speaking it takes a couple of years of a drug being on the market, and there being scientific literature, et cetera, out there, for physicians to start using it and to start prescribing it. And what they realized was that, you know what, we can't afford to wait 2 years anymore. We've got to get this out faster, and we've got to stimulate patients to request the drug from their physicians. And they were very smart in the way they did this, because remember, again, the external construct that's going on here, which is that enormous amount of pressure on both patients and physicians to restrict patient contact, okay, through managed care.
Right.
So it was a classic combination of factors that led to this explosion of prescribing.
So it's not just Big Pharma. The HMOs are there, but aren't doctors also co-conspirators in this? Or is it just that Big Pharma has seduced doctors?
I don't think there's as much seduction in the sense of, we will take you to Acapulco if you prescribe Viagra 100,000 times. It's more like, I think the way it works is like this. A doctor has to see 5 patients an hour, okay, in a big managed care organization. Most people can't be treated in 10 minutes, right?
Yep.
But people expect some kind of resolution to their visit. And so really the writing of a prescription for a relatively benign drug kind of serves as a way to end a physician visit.
So you walk out of there satisfied. Well, at least I got something out of that for my $40 copay.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing for physicians is this enormous drive by patients. You got to remember, it used to be that pharma talked to doctors. Now pharma talks directly to patients.
Right.
And we know that this is about $2.5 billion a year in direct-to-consumer advertising.
Those are those ask your doctor about commercials.
That's right. And what do we know about that? How does that work? Well, we know there's some positive things about it, that it makes people a little more proactive about their health. But we also know that it makes them a little bit too proactive about requesting a drug that they probably don't need. And Vioxx is a perfect example. Remember, Vioxx was approved to treat pain, arthritic pain, in people who had ulcers. Okay? Those were the only people who were supposed to get it. What happened was that the company used so much money in terms of advertising its pain-relieving effects that people said, well, this must be a better pain drug in general. and went to their doctor and required it. And that's why you get these, you know, these tens of thousands of cases now of heart disease, et cetera. Most of these were people who took Viagra but didn't have any kind of ulcer problems, but were responding purely to the commercial, the marketing message.
Mm. You mentioned most patients get in and get maybe 10 minutes with the doctor. That, of course, is after waiting in the waiting room for 30, 40, 50, 60 minutes. I think the easiest way to get in to see your doctor is probably to become a pharmaceutical representative. I see eight of those go in the half hour while I'm sitting in the waiting room.
Well, you know, it's funny. I spend some time around pharmaceutical salesmen and saleswomen, and talk. And there have been some people who've written about this subject who were sales representatives themselves, and you know, they describe it as a seduction game. You know, and there's even one guy who told me a story about I believe he was in Ohio or somewhere, and he kept getting calls from this one doctor for Viagra samples. And he was replacing a salesperson who had been before him. And every time he went to the doctors to take the Viagra samples, the doctor kind of gave him the cold shoulder. And he couldn't quite figure this out. Well, as it turned out, the person who preceded him as a salesman was a saleswoman who was about 25 years old and a complete knockout, and who gave the doctor a back rub.
Ah!
So it really, there's some real hijinks going on in these physicians' offices.
Literal seduction going on there. All right, we'll come back and talk more with Greg Kritzer about Generation RX, his new book subtitled How Prescription Drugs Are Altering American Lives, Minds, and Bodies. This is the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. It's the Paul Harris Show, talking with Greg Kritzer. The book is called Generation RX, How Prescription Drugs Are Altering American Lives, Minds, and Bodies. Have these changes in the way Big Pharma markets to the consumer come about because Big Pharma got better at what they do, or were there legislative changes that gave them the legal backing to do it this way?
It's the latter. You know, if you look at, as I did, at the speeches and comments of pharmaceutical executives in the early 80s, there was once a congressional hearing about the subject of direct-to-consumer advertising, and the head of that committee asked the heads of all the CEOs of Big Pharma to comment on DTC. Every single one of them said it would be the worst thing you could possibly do, because it would interfere with the relationship between the patient and the physician, and that you would stimulate overuse of pills. Interestingly, even the Supreme Court weighed in on this, and this was in the late 70s. Justice Rehnquist, who's generally seen as kind of an anti-regulatory, pro-business kind of guy, weighed in on a case about direct-to-consumer advertising, and he said, "This is the worst thing I've ever heard." He says, "You're going to end up with commercials that say, 'Ask your doctor now.'" Of course, this was 30 years ago before.
Wow.
So it was prescient. And he saw, as he put it, he said, the stakes are high. The notion of a society in which pills are the first line of relief for every ill, both imagined and real, is a huge problem for our society. So he was, you know, and it tells you something, I think it tells you a little bit about how conservative / business thought has evolved over the last 20 years.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, to where that regulatory powers are to be emasculated whenever possible.
And with those regulatory questions, and especially the enormous amount of lobbying that Big Pharma does, I think they have more lobbyists in Washington than pretty much any other industry at this point.
Yeah, I think except oil. I think you're right.
Yeah. What do you think that says about the chances of us ever being able to import drugs from Canada more cheaply?
Yeah, I just don't think that's going to happen. I think there are so many issues. I think you're seeing different states have taken the lead on this, and they found themselves in court over the authority between them and the FDA. So that's a kind of a statutory / legal battle. That's being joined on several different fronts by different organizations. The question is really, I think, twofold for the individual. That is to say, can we find a way to minimize our use of prescription drugs in general? And then secondly, can we find a way for these drugs to be affordable to us? And I think that the solutions that you're going to see are probably going to be more on the state and local level than on the federal level.
Okay, now what about the question of paying for it? And I've only got a minute to go here, so we'll have to keep this part short. But, you know, one company comes out with Viagra, the other company comes out with Cialis. Okay, that's competition. That's the capitalist marketplace that we live in the United States of America. Competition is supposed to be a good thing for the consumer. Is it?
I would say that in many cases it's not. Simply having more choices usually means you end up using more of something. It's like supersizing hamburgers and French fries, which I wrote about in my first book. I mean, you would think that, you know, people would say, well, if you get a good deal with that, well, then perhaps people will split the hamburger between two people. Well, no, all of a sudden everybody had to have a supersized burger. So I think that the notion of choice, unlimited consumer choice, has a fallacy at its core, and that is that, you know, you will somehow find the middle path. And the fact is that the price of finding the middle path for the average person is often costly and dangerous.
If you are interested in finding out more about this, pick up Greg Kritzer's book. It's called Generation RX, How Prescription Drugs Are Altering American Lives, Minds, and Bodies. This is really going to become more important as we of the baby boom move into the, hey, I need more pills generation. But as Greg points out, this is something that starts with kids now, with Ritalin and other behavior modification drugs. Thanks for your time today, Greg.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Greg Kritzer, Generation RX here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.